Everybody's reading the campaign, just like we're
Involved in that. Well, we, I used to box a lot of guys, put the gloves on with them for fun.
They have originals, too. We have two guys on ship, but I don't know what they did, but resume, you gotta fight with them.
That's good. That's real good. Okay, we were talking about different worldviews. We were refuting atheism, and I got right to the end. This, by the way, is philosophy of religion lecture number 5. I'm just going to erase this part of the board here. So we were refuting atheism. I got right to the end. And talking about different worldviews, but with atheism, I just wanted to state the real problem with atheists is not it's not really in the intellectual realm. They might make some intellectual excuses. I like what Ronald Nash says in his book, Faith and Reason, his book on apologetics, that sometimes our intellectual arguments trigger something that the person is suppressing in the unconscious realm or the subconscious realm. For instance, they might really know deep down inside that God exists. In fact, Romans 1 seems to indicate that they do know it, but they suppress it in the unconscious realm because they're in denial, they don't want to accept it. Yet, some argument that we give might just trigger it. For instance, like I'm wearing a Kenny Stabler shirt. I think, to this day, I think he was the greatest quarterback who ever played the game. I saw him pull out game after game after game. If there was any way to win within the rules, he'd win. If there was any way to win the game by cheating, he'd still win. And you could ask John how he was able to pull that off against his team, the Chargers. But in my mind, he was the greatest quarterback ever. But it might be because I'm just biased towards Raiders. The Raiders are my favorite team, and Stabler was his great years were with the Raiders. And somebody else might say Joe Montana is the greatest quarterback ever. And let's just say that I really know deep down inside Montana's the greatest ever. But I'm in denial. I suppressed it in the subconscious realm. Well, maybe one day I'd be sitting down watching Montana play and he throws 6 or 7 touchdown passes and it just gets to the point where it just, it's the straw that broke the camel's back and it just triggers what I already, the knowledge that I already have, but it's in the unconscious realm. And it just triggers it, moves it to the conscious realm, and I admit, okay, Montana is better than Stabler ever was. And that's the type of thing. The problem is really not intellectual in the mind. The problem is moral. It's the will. Look at Romans chapter 1. Did we cover this? You guys, look in your notes, because I might have been this man's 2 greatest drives that I didn't cover.
We get started at the...
Did I touch on those verses? Romans 1?
No.
No? Okay. Romans chapter 1, verses 18 to 22. For the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men who suppress the truth in unrighteousness. They suppress the truth. Okay? Because that which is known about God is evident within them, for God made it evident to them. For since the creation of the world, his invisible attributes, his eternal power and divine nature have been clearly seen, being understood through what has been made, so that they are without excuse. For even though they knew God, it doesn't say that the pagan man's problem is that he doesn't know God. The problem is that they do know God. Even though they knew God, they did not honor him as God or give thanks, but they became futile in their speculations, and their foolish heart was darkened. Professing to be wise, they became fools. Paul saying, professing to be wise, he's a fool who thinks he thinks that we evolved from apes. Okay? Now, it's saying there that they know God exists, but they suppress that knowledge. Now, here it's not talking specifically about atheists. It's talking about pagans who worship the creation or some creature in the creation rather than the true God. But the same holds. All men know that they know that God exists, but they suppress it. So the problem is not intellectual in the mind. The problem is moral in the will. Look at Romans, John, Gospel of John, chapter 3. By the way, as we're covering the worldviews, the only three worldviews that I'm going to cover in depth is atheism, which we've already spent the lecture refuting and we're just finishing up right now. Pantheism, the belief that God is the universe. And then theism, which we're going to defend, the existence of the God of the Bible. We'll touch on the other worldviews, but we're going to really focus on these because these are the three big ones that are competing in America today and throughout the world. The secular humanists are atheists, the pantheists are the New Age movement, and the Christian theists. And so we're going to spend the bulk of our time on those three in the section on worldviews. And then, of course, we'll defend theism when we get to the arguments regarding existence. But John chapter 3, just giving a little more biblical evidence that the real problem with atheists is not in the mind, it's not intellectual, but it's in the will, it's a moral problem. The problem isn't that there isn't enough evidence for Christianity. The problem is they just don't want to accept the evidence. They want to speculate and explain it away because they don't want to bend the knee to Jesus Christ. Right after John 3:16-18, a passage we all know about, that if you believe in Jesus, you'll be saved. If you don't, you'll be lost. Verses 19-21 says this, and this is the judgment, that the light, that's Jesus, is come into the world. And men love the darkness rather than the light, for their deeds were evil. For everyone who does evil hates the light and does not come to the light, lest his deeds should be exposed. See, it's a moral problem. They don't want to bend the knee to Jesus, they want to do their own thing. Verse 21, but he who practices the truth comes to the light. Now, he who practices the truth is not a believer. Because if he was a believer, he wouldn't have to come to the light because he already would have come to the light. The one who practices the truth there is kind of what you might call a truth seeker. He's not perfect, he's sinful, just like the other guy. But he doesn't love the darkness. He's there, but he doesn't love the darkness. He's fed up with the darkness. And whatever bit of truth God reveals to him about himself, the sinner, the man, and God, the guy accepts and he acts upon. He acts upon whatever truth God gives him. God reveals himself in creation, in nature, and he says, okay, an all-powerful, all-just God must exist. Then God reveals himself to this guy in his conscience, Romans 2:14-15, that Gentiles, they don't even have God's written law, they've got God's moral laws written on their hearts and in their conscience. This guy says, hey, I got a guilty conscience. An almighty God exists and I can't get to him on my own. I need to look to him for the way to be saved. And so these guys that practice whatever truth the Lord gives them, eventually the Lord reveals to them not the lesser light, creation and conscience, but the greater light, the Lord Jesus Christ, and then they accept him. So he says, but he who practices the truth comes to the light, that his deeds may be manifested as having been wrought in God. By the way, what about the people that have never heard, sometimes entire civilizations have never heard of the gospel? Multitudes of people die without hearing of Jesus Christ. Some people say that they're saved without accepting Christ. I disagree. I think there are little children that die before they reach the age of accountability, go to heaven, and they're covered by Christ's sacrifice because they never rejected it. At the same time, I think it's the problem that they were not practicing the truth. If they would have practiced the truth, if they would have acted upon the truth that God gave them, his proving his existence through creation, and their fallenness through their conscience, and they would have looked for the great Creator God, then God would have sent the missionary and got the salvation message to them. So I think that every person who would accept Christ, God will see to it that they get the gospel message preached to them so that they will accept Christ. I don't think there's going to be a guy burning in hell because Phil Fernandez didn't get the gospel message to him. If a guy would accept the gospel message, God will find someone. If Phil Fernandez don't want to do it, God will find someone who's willing to do it. And I have to be honest, if nobody is willing to do it, there was one guy who was so bad, nobody wanted to witness to him. And so Jesus met him on on the road to Damascus. But he who practices the truth comes to the light, that his deeds may be manifested as having been wrought in God. So the real problem is not intellectual in the mind. The real problem is moral. It's in the will. And this goes to what I call man's two greatest drives. Man's two greatest drives. One is the drive for human autonomy. All that means is you want to be your own boss, okay? And the other is our thirst for transcendence. Transcendence. What that is, it's just simply our thirst for something more. Okay? Mike Tyson wants to be the heavyweight champ of the world. He wins the heavyweight championship of the world. And guess what? He's still not happy. He's still not happy. Gets himself in a lot of trouble. We always think, if I could just have this one thing, then I'd be happy. We get there, and that doesn't make us happy. We're always thirsting for something more. For Karl Marx, it was the utopian society. In essence, I think what this thirst for something more is actually our thirst for God. God has put within each one of us a drive towards transcendence, our thirst for God, but also a drive for human autonomy, our desire to be our own God. I think this is the essence of free will. The essence of free will is whether you're going to be king or whether you're going to let God be king. C.S. Lewis said that the whole issue of this life, the whole test, is whether you're going to say, not my will, but your will be done, Lord, or whether you're going to say, not your will, but my will be done, Lord. And hell is where those people go who don't bend the knee and have their thirst for God. When Jesus said, in John 6:35, I am the bread of life, he who comes to me will not hunger, and he who believes in me will never thirst. I think this is what he's saying. Every person has a thirst for God, and I alone can quench that thirst. But unfortunately, most people are like King Herod, and refuse to come off the throne in their life for the baby Jesus. So the real problem with the atheist, though, is not even in the intellectual realm, but we still do need to argue intellectually, because we may be able to trigger some of this, the truth that they may already know that they're suppressing. What I want to do right now is discuss pantheism. The second worldview that I want to touch on there. There's a lot of different kinds of pantheism. Geisler discusses that in his introduction to philosophy that he co-authored with Paul Feinberg. There's absolute, first off, all pantheistic views, all pantheists are monists. A monist believes that all reality is one. That's what monism means. All reality is one. And so all pantheists are monistic. They believe that reality is ultimately one being. But there's different degrees of this monism, of this pantheism. Parmenides, who was a Greek philosopher, he held to absolute pantheism, where it just basically meant that all things are one. All diversity is an illusion. Okay? All diversity. He said the only way to differentiate between two things is either being or non-being. That's the way Parmenides argued. And he argued that things can't differ in non-being, because non-being is nothing, that they would differ by nothing. And then he said they can't differ in being, since being means that which exists, and since both things exist, they're identical then. Everything is being. So that was his argument. That's a weak argument, because you could have different kinds of beings, such as one infinite being and many finite limited beings. But he held to absolute pantheism. Emanational pantheism, emanational, was held to by Plotinus. He taught that all multiplicity unfolds from the one. So you have one being and everything else emanates from it. So the individual things are a little bit more real than Parmenides would allow it, but in reality we're just emanations, the unfolding of the one, but ultimately there still only is one being. There's multi-level pantheism, such as in Hinduism, multi-level pantheism. Brahman, B-R-A-H-M-A-N, Brahman is the highest level of reality. Brahman is the highest level of reality. Brahman is beyond all multiplicity and beyond all materiality. Okay? In Hinduism, Brahman is manifested, though, on lower levels. The world is not total illusion, but it is the lowest degree. The material realm is not total illusion, but it is the lowest degree of reality. It's less real. A lot of the stuff with the Hinduism actually predates Plato, but a lot of, like Plotinus, you know, he was into Platonic thought. Plato, that which was ultimately real was the realm of the ideas, the invisible forms, the invisible universals, so that the realm of the particulars, the physical realm, was less real. And so even Plato's thought led in this direction, though he was not a pantheist. But you can see a relationship between his view and pantheism. Modal pantheism was held by Benedict Spinoza. Modal pantheism. Spinoza held that there's only one absolute substance in the universe, and everything else is only a mode or a moment of it. Only one absolute substance in the universe. Everything else is only a mode or a moment of it. And to really simplify it and oversimplify it, it would be like Phil Fernandez is like a microsecond in the life of God type of thing. Okay, I'm just part of the universe. Maybe I'm a cell in the universe, or just one moment of God's existence. Then, Hegel, the philosopher Hegel, he held a developmental pantheism that the one absolute spirit unfolds itself through the developments of history. The one absolute spirit unfolds itself through the developments of history. Hegel had the view of the dialectic, where you have a thesis, and then you have the exact opposite, the antithesis of it, and you would have a synthesis of the two. Instead of one thing being true and the other being false, one was true for one time, and then the exact opposite is true for another time, and then you have a synthesis of the two. Marx, although he was a materialist and Hegel was an idealist, Marx took the Hegelian dialectic and applied it to economic systems, so that capitalism, contrary to popular belief, you can't understand Marx without at least a basic understanding of Hegel. He got so much of his philosophy from him, but Marx really didn't believe capitalism was evil. He believed capitalism was good for its day, when it was the thesis. But then the antithesis, a communistic system, needed to come up, and then there would be kind of a struggle between the capitalistic thesis and the communistic antithesis, and then there would be a synthesis of the two, which would eventually be the utopian society. So something is good or evil relative to when it's occurring. What's good for one era is not good for another era. And but Hegel and his thought, and by the way, Marx wasn't a pantheist, he was an atheist, but Hegel and his thought actually got away from absolute, the idea of absolute truth. You had, instead of thinking in terms of antithesis, if something is true, its opposite must be false. Hegel dealt with synthesis.
If something is true, its opposite will eventually be true.
Yeah. And those are just some different types of pantheist beliefs. The common elements in pantheism. Common elements in pantheism is that God is non-personal. God is non-personal. He's not a God who loves us. He's not a God. God is not a God who can command us what is right and what is wrong. He's not a moral being. God is beyond morality. Okay? So God is non-personal. Creation is not ex nihilo. Creation is not out of nothing like the theist believes, but creation is out of God. Creation is out of God, not out of nothing. So in reality, creation is part of God's being. So only, the third common element of pantheism, only one being exists. Only one being exists. That's monism. But let me tell you this. All pantheists are monists, but not all monists are pantheists. Okay? Well, what I mean by that is monism says all reality is one.
Pantheism defines the one.
And pantheism defines the one as God. Okay? But that monist doesn't have to define the one as God. A monist could believe everything is one and decide that this one being that everything is not worthy of worship. And so the monist doesn't have to be a pantheist, but the pantheist by definition must be a monist. So the third common element of pantheism is only one being exists, that's monism, and that this one being is God. So God is the universe. Another common element of pantheism, if it's a consistent pantheist, evil is not real, it is an illusion. Evil is not real, it is an illusion. What I'd like to do now is refute some of these premises of pantheism, some of the common elements of pantheism. I've got two different sets of notes. I'm trying to see which is going to be best. First off, Parmenides, his pantheism, remember where he said things can only differ, things cannot differ by being because they all exist, and they can't differ by non-being because it's different by non-being, it's different by nothing. He assumes that being must be understood univocally, in other words, in entirely the same sense. Okay. However, the Christian holds that being can be understood analogically, in a similar sense. In other words, one being is infinite, and all other being is finite. So you can have finite, limited beings who differ. We all share actuality, the actual pole of being. See, in Thomistic terminology, being as an actual goal and a potential goal. Parmenides only recognized the actual goal. The actual goal means that which is. So, in Parmenides' thinking, everything that has being, everything that exists, exists. See, being is being. And so everything that has being is actual. So he saw everything as one. It looks like it's an illusion, but it looks like there's a lot of different beings, but there's really only one being, because everything that exists is being. Everything that exists is actual. Well, Aquinas says, being has an actual pole and a potential pole. And the fact that God exists means that God is. Okay? So the actual pole. The fact that man exists means that man is. We are the actual pole. But the thing is, we have different potentialities. God has infinite potential. Man has finite potential. And so Aquinas said that, you know, with this actual potential pole, you could have differences. For instance, God, number one, God is being, but man only has being. God is being, but he gives man being. So in other words, Parmenides' argument really would hold weight before creation. Okay, because then the whole being, in other words, infinite being must be one. Aquinas actually uses the same type of argumentation that Parmenides uses. Aquinas uses it to argue that there can only be one infinite being. There can only be one God. And but the fact that we are finite beings derived being rather than pure being means that you can have more than one being. There can be multitudes of finite beings who differ in their potentialities, even though we all have actuality, we all exist, but there can only be one unlimited being. But anyway, all I'm getting at is that Parmenides assumes that since being means that which is, everything that has being must be the same. He views all being as exactly the same type of being, and Aquinas is saying no. There's, you know, man, for a rock is actual, and a man is actual, but they don't have the same potentialities.
Some they have, no.
Well, yeah, maybe. a rock doesn't have potential to talk. To verbalize. A rock doesn't have potential to love. A dog may have potential to eat food like a man does, but a dog doesn't have potential to have a relationship with God like man does. So we differ in our potentialities. But Parmenides' pantheism assumes too much. Also, pantheists must trust their sense. They say, you know, the physical world is, the world of diversity is an illusion. But pantheists must trust their senses like everyone else.
Even though diversity is an illusion, they still have to make a choice between the poisonous mushroom and the non-poisonous.
Yeah, they got, just like John Cage, they got to decide which mushroom is poisonous, which mushroom isn't. If you throw a knuckle sandwich at them, they got to decide if they're going to block it or if they're going to scream or whatever. They still eat three meals a day. When it rains out, they put an umbrella up over their head, and they're telling you that the physical realm doesn't exist, but they sure live like it doesn't. They're on the train tracks, they hear a train whistle of an oncoming train, they get out of the way. Pantheists must trust their senses like everyone else, and our senses tell us that reality is many. You know, just think about that for a minute, that a guy is trying to a pantheist is trying to convince you that only one being exists in the universe. It seems to me that to try to persuade you of anything, he has to first assume that you're a separate existence from him. The argument that I use for many beings, that many beings exist, I use Geisler's actual principle of actual undeniability, where Geisler says that in order to deny your own existence, you have to first exist in order to make the denial. Because nothing is nothing, therefore nothing can do nothing, therefore nothing can deny nothing. Just the fact that you make the denial means you have to exist first in order to deny anything. So just to deny your own existence, say, I do not exist, you have to exist to make that denial. So I must exist even to deny my own existence. Therefore, it's actually undeniable that I do exist. But when I communicate to others, even if I try to persuade them that they don't exist or that we're both the same being, when I communicate to others, I affirm their separate and individual existence. Okay? I'm a pantheist and I'm communicating to you, John, and I'm trying to convince you that we're one being. I have to assume that you're a separate existence from me, that you disagree with me, and that I've got to try to change your mind so that you start to think like I think.
And why do pantheists try to evangelize, so to speak, other people if they're pantheism? What's the point? Beyond fundraising.
Yeah, the same question, Francis Schaeffer asked the same question. What he says in his words, man cannot stop being man, and man cannot stop living in the real universe, no matter what fairy tale beliefs he has. And so what he's arguing is that you can deny Christianity all you want, you still have to live in the real world, which is the world that the Bible describes. So Francis Schaeffer argues that the only worldview that is really livable, the only people who can, not all Christians do, but the only people who can or are able to live consistent with the worldview are Christians. A secular humanist in one of their manifestos, they wrote, "We believe all values are autonomous and situational." In other words, each person decides what is right for themselves. Nobody can tell you. Less than a paragraph later, or in the very next paragraph, they said that we are for all types of sexual acts between two consenting adults. So what are they saying? They're saying we're against rape because one of the parties is not consenting, and we're against having sex with children. And I agree with them on both those points. But the fact is, they're resurrecting Christian moral values right after they said, throw the Christian moral values out the window. And, so Francis Schaeffer would say, you can deny with your lips the Christian worldview, but you have to live in God. You can deny the existence of God, but you still got to live in His reality. And so Schaeffer says everybody, from their own presuppositions, everybody's presuppositions leads to a certain conclusion. And the only one who can live consistently with those presuppositions are the Christians. And what we need to do is show people, well, what are you doing over here when your presuppositions lead you out here? John Cage, you say everything got here by chance, yet you're living up here and acting like there's a there's a purpose and design in the universe so that you can tell the difference between a poisonous mushroom and a non-poisonous one. You ought to just live by chance. It's a chance universe. It's irrelevant. Nothing matters. Nothing makes sense. And but he's living like the God of the Bible doesn't exist. So pantheists, just in order to communicate to others to try to persuade them to be pantheists, they must affirm the separate individual existence of others. No one also lives like evil is an illusion. Look at the New Age pantheists, the New Agers that are out there. They live like the world really does exist, and like there is really evil in it. I mean, they're always protesting, you know, they're a bunch of no-nukes, they're always protesting war. Why work for peace when there is no war? I mean, if they think war is evil, since they classify evil as an illusion, that would make war an illusion. Why protest and work for peace when there's no such thing as evil? Why protest for anything? And so this whole idea that evil is just an illusion, and that the world, the physical world, is an illusion, New Agers, pantheists live, trust their senses and live like everybody else. They live like their views are false. If you get any philosophical view that cannot be lived, is not worth holding. Okay? If you can't live what you claim to believe, it ain't worth believing. Okay? No one lives like evil is an illusion. You go out and beat the tar on the pantheist and watch how quick those cops come, because he's gonna stagger to a non-existent phone that's an illusion. He's gonna dial 911 and two non-existent illusionary cops are gonna come and cart you away. No one lives like evil is an illusion. Everybody admits evil when they're wrong. That's why Jesus said, "Do to others what you would have them do to you." He didn't say, "Treat others the way you think they should be treated," because then we'd still put ourselves first. He said, "Treat others the way you want to be treated." You know how greedy we are, how selfish we are. Everybody admits evil when we're the ones who are being wrong. You know, if you're a little kid, you stole a cookie, you got a million really good excuses why it was right that you stole that cookie. But if it was the last cookie and your brother stole it, with no excuse. You're not supposed to eat cookies before supper or this and that. So when you're the one who's wrong, you're always going to admit evil. The whole, you know, New Agers, they're getting back to that evil aspect. Pantheists cannot call Adolf Hitler evil and be consistent with their views. And I used to arrest pantheists at Bangor. Not all of them were pantheists. A lot of them were actually Catholics who were protesting the nuclear weapons. But I had a pantheist one day tell me, you know, "Don't you realize that you're going to lead to the destruction of the planet and that you're just following these people just like the Nazis followed Hitler and never asked any questions and this and that?" And, you know, this lady doesn't even, her worldview, she has no right to call Hitler evil. If evil is an illusion, you cannot say that Hitler was wrong. Now, as Christians who believe in a personal God who has spoken and who has told us what is right and what is wrong, we have every right within our viewpoint to call Adolf Hitler's actions evil. Once you say there's no such thing as right and wrong, you can't condemn anybody. Jean-Paul Sartre said that, you know, we have to create our own values because there's no such thing as right and wrong. And there he is, protesting and here and there and arguing that Marxism is the best form of government and we should fight for it. It's like, the guy's not even living close to what his worldview says. Pantheists are also famous for holding to the view that there is no such thing as absolute truth. There's no such thing as absolute truth. There are no absolutes. There is no absolute truth. The problem is, if the statement, there are no absolute truths, if that statement is true, it would be an absolute truth. So if it's true, it contradicts itself, so it can't be true. And if it's false, it's false. So it's a self-refuting statement. All self-refuting statements must be false, okay? So, you know, it's almost like the pantheist is trying to tell you, look, there are no absolute truths, and I'm just trying to get this truth across to you. And, you know, and obviously, it's, you know, it's like, the lady said in the debate, the lady professor, she said in the debate they did on God's existence, she said, well, the Buddhists say God is.
Professor?
Well, yeah.
She's a student.
No, she's a militant feminist, New Age professor. And, at Lower Columbia College, on the debate of God's existence. But she said, the Buddhists say that God is and God is not. And that's good enough for me. It's like, you know, no one can live in that kind of world.
Just sort of, well, then you're right and you're wrong.
Yeah.
And you should have no problem
with that. I agree with you 100%. I disagree with you 100%. Next question. That's about all they deserve there. Also, did you have...
I'm kind of a little bit further back and kind of create my own values and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And then went off and tried to talk to this and whatever. What about world consensus? I think I heard you talk about that in my conversation before, but I'm still not sure about the argument against that. What would you argue against somebody who
said there's a lot of ways that you can force. Sometimes they'll be consistent with their views. I give you that consistent idea on Does God Exist, where I gave a talk at the college and a couple guys questioned me afterwards. I'll bring one in for you, because there were two atheists and they were trying with everything they had to have some type of morality without absolute universals. And what I backed them into a corner on was I got them to admit that since the consensus, these guys were holding to society, but you could spread it throughout the world, because slavery was accepted part of the world until the West. The West did not, Western culture did not start slavery. Western culture stopped it. Now granted, it was a sin of the West. We did partake in it, but eventually our Christian conscience caused us to put a stop to it. That was new. Stopping slavery was new. The non-slaves standing up for the slaves was something unheard of. And only a Christian would do something like that. Slavery was a part of man, so you could do it on a world scale. But what I argued with these guys, I got them to admit that 150 years ago, if you were in the South, I said, well, would it be right or wrong to put a whip to the back of a young black man who wasn't doing what you were telling him to do, and if he was one of your slaves? And I got these two young guys to admit, it's wrong today, but it wasn't wrong back then. And that's a pretty, you know, God wants to live with a view like that. That's a pretty shabby view to live with. But what I did then was I told them, so that if what you're saying is true, you have no way to guarantee to me that in 150 years from now, it might be right to do that again. And he had to admit, yeah. And but with world consensus, the world consensus was, well, one time that the world is flat. If we're wrong in that area, in the area of science, could we not also be wrong in the area of morals? what if you have, what if world consensus is real split? You know, we act like world consensus, like everybody goes to a voting booth and we all vote all over, but, you know, look at most of the countries in the world today. A bunch of ruthless totalitarian regimes, torture. That's why the United Nations, 80% of the time that the United States disagreed with the Soviet Union, the United Nations sided with the Soviet Union. But world consensus, it's been wrong before, it could be wrong again. World consensus once thought slavery was all right, and now we seem to think that it's not all right, but only the Christian can say slavery was always wrong. But somebody like the, I should say only the Christian, but only, pretty much only theists can say always, can say that slavery was always wrong. You get, you know, pantheist or atheist, anybody who denies the absolute moral law would have to admit that there could have been a time when slavery was okay, and it could be a time in the future when it's okay. But world consensus, all you're doing is you're taking it from the individual, saying the individual determines what is right and wrong for himself. You're just multiplying individuals. Whether you go to a society or whether you go to world consensus, you're just adding more and more. You're quantitatively trying to find a moral law. But if there's nothing higher than men in the universe, or that we know of, then the moral law still isn't above.